Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. From Wondery.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty good, Justin. How are you feeling this evening?
I'm doing good. Do we have any announcements to make?
If you would like extra content from Generation Y, don't forget we have a Patreon page. If you want more content from us, more episodes, head over there. The last episode we did, Justin.
That episode's about a family that just wanted to go out furniture shopping when an armed criminal holed up in their home while police had a standoff. What happens next is pretty unbelievable, and you'll need to go out to our Patreon to hear what happens next.
Patreon.com/Generation Y for just $2 a month. You get an extra episode, plus whatever else we decide to throw up there. Sometimes old episodes I remaster and put up.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 20 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. Bodhi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with Bodhi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of Bodhi and save 65%. Just go to Bodhi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Tonight's case happens in Missouri. I actually didn't know about this case, so it's a lesser known one, which is pretty cool. It's about a murder that happens in a household, and the husband says two intruders came in, but the police think something different. So with that, Aaron, what are we talking about tonight?
We're talking about an incident that happened on September 28, 1994 in Fremont Hills, Missouri, which apparently is very close to Springfield. So in the southern part of the state. Justin, one of the things you're fond of saying is small town. This is a very small town. Apparently back in the 90s, only about 1,000 residents lived in this town.
And when we say small town, we're not trying to be disparaging. A lot of small town folks are proud of their small towns. I would be too. So, yeah. And this is Fremont Hills, and this involves the mayor of that small town.
He was the mayor, and he's a banker. His wife was Lisa. She was an Ozark Elementary teacher, and they had two children.
In 1992, they had purchased a home that cost $342,000. Now, with inflation and all that, you can essentially double that amount. So this is over a $600,000 home, and they renovated it, adding an additional $100,000. So lots of money going on here. It's a wealthy area, and on this particular date, something bad happens. This was September 28th, 1994. At 5 a.m., police officers are dispatched to the home. There's a security system that's alerted them. When they arrive, George was at the front door talking on the phone, and he says, "They shot my wife. They shot my wife." So he'll end up leading the investigators to the bedroom where his wife, Lisa, has been shot in the head. She was taken to the hospital, but she was declared dead a few hours later. She was 37 years old. Both of their children were upstairs at the time of the murder and stayed upstairs in their bedrooms even after the officers arrived. They weren't initially questioned. Now, it was early morning. And if anyone has lived in the Midwest, you have morning dew. Everything's wet. And the officers, as they approached the home, they didn't see anyone fleeing the home. They didn't see anyone running from the home, any cars at this hour. And they looked around the house, and there wasn't any tracks leading away from the house. So if there's wet grass and you run through it, it mashes it down. And you'll leave a trail. Just right off the bat, officers don't see any evidence of anyone that has left the home. They spoke with some of the neighbors, and one of the neighbors actually got a call from the alarm company. You would think, how did that happen? But in small towns, this alarm company, they know everybody, and they probably have installed alarm systems in every home in this neighborhood. So when the alarm was tripped, and they couldn't get a hold of George, they called a neighbor. And the neighbor said, "I don't hear or see anything going on. I don't know what's happening." Also, they had newspaper delivery people out that morning. They didn't see anything or hear anything. Now, the garage door was open just a couple feet. George's family had a cat, and they left the garage door just slightly ajar so the cat could come and go at night.
They were just checking to see if maybe the intruders had gone into the garage.
And being that they couldn't find any signs of forced entry, they're assuming that these intruders entered and left via the garage. But they would have had to have gotten down on like their bellies and low crawled underneath the garage door and entered the house. Also, the family had a dog, and the dogs were not barking when police arrived. But after they arrived, the family dogs started barking at the police.
So again, no evidence of any break-in, no evidence of any shoe prints or boot prints, anything like that in the grass or on the property. At this point, if they believe there were intruders, they're just taking George's word for it because they can't find any evidence.
So they're looking around the home. They're trying to see if these intruders left any signs. And they end up finding a piece of paper in the bathroom with the codes to the alarm system. And they went down into the basement and they ended up finding a note from Lisa, George's wife, and a cursory glance at that note. It was a letter written to George talking about her dissatisfaction with the marriage and how she couldn't live like this anymore. Doesn't bode well for this situation.
She ended the note by saying that she did love him, but she just couldn't live like that anymore. It is definitely something that would cause the average person or even the average detective, I would imagine, to think, this might be a motive. Maybe she wanted to leave him.
Now, George says that he was woken up by the alarm system and he went to investigate, but he went into the bathroom to grab his shotgun. But before he could get it, these intruders entered the bedroom and one held a gun to Lisa's head and told him to turn off the alarm. When George went to deactivate the alarm, he heard a gunshot and then the alarm went off again. He saw the intruders shoot his wife and then exit through the garage door, and that all happened at 4:57 a.m. He said the intruders were wearing dark clothes. One was wearing a baseball cap backwards. Both intruders were wearing masks, and they determined that the gun used was a .45 caliber pistol. But again, nothing really added up with his story. And they couldn't verify his story with any evidence within the home.
And a big part of that was because there was no gun found that would have caused Lisa's death. In other words, no handgun was found.
No murder weapon.
So where is it? If there was one thing you could point to early on that says maybe George had nothing to do with this, it's the fact that the murder weapon is missing. If there were intruders, they must have taken it with them.
This looks pretty suspicious, but law enforcement doesn't have enough to use against George at this point. All they have is their gut instinct of, doesn't look like anyone broke into the home, but we don't have a murder weapon. So we're just going to collect evidence, talk to people, and then see what pans out. And they don't have to wait long, do they, Aaron?
No, they don't. And that's because they investigate George, and it turns out he was embezzling money.
He worked at the Ozark Bank and he was stealing money from the bank. What better place to steal money from, right?
He was also, because he was mayor, able to embezzle money from the town.
Wow. That expensive house they bought, the renovations they had done were way over budget. So it's shown by his bank accounts that he was pretty much broke because of this house and his overspending. What else did they find about George leading up to this murder?
They also discovered that he had taken out a life insurance policy on his wife to the tune of $500,000, and it was a double indemnity policy, which just means, depending on what happened to his wife, it could end up paying double. So if she were murdered or had an accident, then it could pay double. For a man with debt, it could solve his problems.
They end up talking to people around town and finding out that George was somewhat paranoid. That's why he had this elaborate security system installed on his home. And he was in the market to buy a gun for home defense.
he had been asking people he knew about guns, about what type of weapon would be good for home defense. And it seemed through conversations with various people that he had decided upon a 45 caliber handgun, which, as we know, just happened to be the same caliber gun used to murder his wife. One of the things that he had asked about was stopping power, which is interesting because he had a shotgun that has pretty good stopping power.
Yeah. And a shotgun is far more intimidating than a handgun, but a shotgun was kept in the other room, or according to him, it was, so he couldn't get to it in time to save his wife and defend his home. And apparently these intruders were just there to hold him hostage and kill his wife and then take off, I guess. I don't know.
It almost sounds like George is trying to say that the shooting may have been an accident. In other words, they didn't intend to shoot Lisa. This just came down to the gun accidentally went off, that they had actually intended to get money from him. So it would be a robbery or extortion attempt.
There were events before this where the police were dispatched to the home for a possible prowler. This was actually the day before. And the same officer, Officer Hicks, was dispatched. And George told him that the motion detector lights had gone off and he wanted Hicks to check around the house. But the officer found nothing and didn't see any footprints in the grass, nothing to indicate that anyone was around the home. It doesn't mean nobody was there. It just means that the officer didn't find anything there the night before. And then a little over 24 hours later, something happens.
So does this back up George's story? Did he have a right to be paranoid? There were some friends of this couple that had hung out with them and talked with them. And one of the conversations they had, and Lisa was also saying this, is they heard about how there may have been people stalking them or prowling around their home, and they were nervous.
He is the mayor of the town. Maybe he did something that some of the residents didn't like.
He's also a bank manager, so perhaps someone might see him as a target if they would like some easy money.
Now, these officers, they're thinking, wow, you're under investigation, you're embezzling money, and you took out a life insurance policy for at least the amount that you were in debt for, but possibly double, and now your wife has been murdered kind of out of the blue. So they're allowing this embezzlement investigation to proceed while they kind of just collect more evidence. And it's in March of 1995 where George is charged with 18 counts of embezzlement, misapplication of bank funds, and money laundering. He pleads guilty to 17 of those 18 counts and agrees to serve 27 months in prison. But 27 months, you know, that's a little over 2 years. Law enforcement's thinking, we need to go after him for the murder of his wife now.
He was indicted the following month in April of 95, but the trial wouldn't begin until 96. Because it was a murder and because it looked like it was planned, the state wanted to pursue the death penalty.
Now, can I stop you there real quick, Aaron? Because I always thought that the death penalty was used for the most heinous crimes. And I'm not trying to dismiss somebody who planned the murder of their wife. But if just first-degree murder is all you need for the death penalty, then at least in Missouri, we need not put the definition on the most heinous crimes is what we reserve capital punishment for, because we don't. We just throw it out there willy-nilly.
A case like this, life in prison should be sufficient.
That's typically how we interpret the death penalty, is unless there was torture or unless there were multiple felonies committed in the commission of a homicide, we don't use the death penalty, but they're throwing it out there. And the only reason why I bring this up is because when it is a capital murder trial, when the death penalty is on the table, it's harder for a jury to convict. The jury wants all the evidence. The jury wants to be absolutely sure before they end a life. So it's a lot easier to put somebody away for life as opposed to knowing that you're going to have the state kill them.
September 7th, 1995, George Revell was sentenced based on his embezzlement charges. But that's not the most interesting thing that happened, was it?
Oh, no. This is where the plot thickens.
This anonymous letter shows up at the Christian County Sheriff's Office. And this letter is basically a confession of sorts. It says that George Revell was innocent of the crime, that the crime was actually committed by two men who were accomplices of a man by the name of Ronnie Kistler, who just happened to be George Revell's half-brother, and who also died in a car accident 2 weeks before Lisa's murder.
How convenient.
The letter explained that Ronnie had planned to hold George Revell at gunpoint so that he could get him to withdraw money from his bank. Kistler's accomplices, without Ronnie, decided to go ahead with the plan anyway. But because the shooting of Lisa was accidental, they panicked and fled. So what about the codes, the alarm codes that were found on a sheet of paper in the bathroom? Well, it says before the murder, these same two men broke into the Revell home to get the alarm codes.
Also in this letter is where law enforcement can find the murder weapon, which has been ditched in a pond somewhere in town.
Well, they take this note very seriously, and they go to the property where this pond is. This property was rented by Kistler and his wife. So maybe there's some truth to this letter?
Well, there is truth to the letter because it's saying his brother-in-law, his half-brother, and the property is owned by him, and they find a gun, a 45 caliber pistol, at the bottom of this pond, wrapped in duct tape. So at least the gun, the murder weapon, is truthful. Is anything else in this letter the truth? That's up to our listeners to decide.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
George Revell began serving his time for the embezzlement charges in October of 1995.
But in 1996, they pull him out to stand trial for the murder of his wife. And the prosecution has a lot of circumstantial evidence going against George. They have the fact that nobody saw anyone coming or going from the home that morning, which, hey, it's 5 a.m. in the morning, people are asleep. But they bring in the security company and they do a forensic analysis of the alarms, and they show that only one alarm was triggered, and it was in the bedroom that morning. There weren't multiple alarms. So, as you remember, George said he was awoken to the alarm. He went to turn it off, and then it was triggered again from the intruders in the bedroom. Well, there was only one trigger, and that was in the bedroom. And if you shoot a gun off in a house, that's probably going to trigger the alarm. But the areas of the house, like the garage or the outside, nothing was triggered. So this is really going against George and his story about intruders breaking in. The defense counters the alarm system not going off because they claim Lisa had gone to the garage the night prior to retrieve some papers and turned off the zone of, you know, the alarm zone of the garage. So therefore, if somebody entered that way, it wouldn't alert anyone. And then there's the question of the letter that Lisa wrote. And this becomes a huge debate during trial because the letter essentially is Lisa writing a letter to George saying, "You have anger problems. I don't want a big house. I don't want all this stuff. I just want somebody who loves me and cares about me. And I can't live like this anymore," meaning the marriage is on the rocks. But this letter is highly disputed in the courtroom because the defense is saying it's hearsay and deeming it inadmissible, or trying to get it deemed inadmissible, whereas the prosecution is saying, no, this is relevant. And when the police questioned George during the interrogation, they asked him, "How's your marriage going?" And George says, "It's perfect up until today," meaning it was perfect up until the murder happened. And then the investigators pulled the note out from Lisa, and George looked completely defeated. And they said, "Do you know what this is?" And he said, "Yes." So George knows that this letter exists, and he knows that he's been caught in a lie during the interrogation. But at trial, the defense is trying to say that this note, this letter, was written years prior to the murder, whereas the state or the prosecution can really only prove that it was maybe written 6 months before the incident, the murder. So the question is this letter, is this note hearsay? Because was her state of mind still valid at the time of the murder? Well, you can't say.
But I don't think that's exactly how they handle this, because the judge has to make a determination here, and it certainly feels like the judge decided that it may be relevant, because much of the prosecution's case depends on George and Lisa not getting along. Why else is he asking about a gun? Why is he taking out this life insurance policy? Why is there a call the day before? Why, on the day that he's sentenced on the embezzlement charges, does a sheriff's department suddenly get a letter where someone's explaining who actually did the crime? It seems like there are so many convenient things going on that indicate that George is responsible here. The judge decides to let it in.
And this is where this is our legal system. The actual content of the letter is relevant to the case, but the argument is it hearsay? And they really base that off of the time it was written. And they cannot prove that it was written the day before or even any time, you know, within the last 6 months of the murder. So it's a serious point of contention.
My understanding is that the prosecutor, Kenny Halsoff, is really the reason why this court found in the prosecution's favor, because he's very good at making little things into big things. And what I mean by that is he finds this note. And since we don't really know when it was written for sure, we don't really know how relevant it is to the case. We just know at one time their marriage was not perfect. It was far from perfect because it sounded like Lisa wanted out. But that's what he's telling the judge is this is her state of mind. This explains why she died. And so I think he was able to convince the judge. It's just that simple. And the defense is saying, come on, it's hearsay. We don't have her to tell us how relevant this note is. We also don't know when it was written. So how do we know it has anything to do with this? Why couldn't it just be two intruders who shot Lisa and fled? And the police just happened not to find any evidence of an intruder.
And that's a very valid assessment, because you can go into a house, shoot somebody and leave and not leave any evidence. If you don't touch anything, you're not leaving any fingerprints. If you're not running through the grass, you're not leaving footprints. You can enter a home and leave a home, especially if the garage door is ajar, and not leave any evidence. And they find the duct tape on the gun. They claim that it matches duct tape in the house. But, I mean, duct tape's duct tape. How do you match it? I mean, if I go to the hardware store and buy a roll of duct tape and you go to a hardware store and buy that same roll, well, this is a small town. There's probably only one or two brands of duct tape that you can buy at that time. So the defense is really hammering all the circumstantial evidence home. But how do you explain the alarm system not triggering? How do you explain that this guy was in debt, he was embezzling money, and he had taken an insurance policy out on his wife that was going to pay him out and save the day financially?
Also, life insurance policies, they don't just continue on for eternity. You have to continue to pay on them to keep them up to date. And this life insurance policy on Lisa Revelle, it was about to expire. This guy was in debt. So who knows if he could have kept that policy going? This is what the prosecution tells the jury. They say George killed his wife so he could get the insurance money to take care of his debt. Because just like she mentioned in her letter to him, George had a thing for material possessions. And like with the house and anything else he was a part of, he wanted to go big. They just couldn't sustain that. Not at the rate he was going. So all they had to do is point to that. They pointed to George lying because he lied to the police. That's what this note shows. That's another way this note is important, at least to the prosecution's case. It showed things weren't perfect. That's why he reacted the way he did. They said his face fell when he realized what they were holding.
The prosecution really hammers home that this letter proves that the marriage was on the rocks, and use it as motive.
The security company, they determined that there couldn't have been an intruder in the home. So this is looking bad for George. But the defense, they're trying to argue that there was no evidence tying him to this crime. But while they're saying that, I think they're having problems because the prosecution has been putting up fact after fact, as they call it, showing that George had every reason and every motive and every opportunity to commit this crime, and they didn't have any evidence of anyone else's involvement. Even more damning, they allege that while George was walking around the house on the phone, he was also hiding the gun. And they claim that after the police left, he then was able to move the gun to this pond. The letter that was insinuating that he was not guilty, well, they're saying he wrote that letter. He sent it to the sheriff's office.
Both sides have their points, but both sides are looking at the other's evidence and saying, well, that's just alleged or that's just circumstantial. How do you know he hid the gun before the cops came and then dumped it in the pond and then wrote a letter. But looking at this, Aaron, I think, no, that's the perfect long game of trying to get yourself off for a murder. Is you say somebody broke into the house, murdered your wife, you hide the murder weapon, you dump it somewhere, and then you write a letter giving law enforcement just enough information to make it credible, hence saying where the murder weapon can be found. That makes, hey, these intruders that were hired by his half-brother are real too. This whole letter is credible, believe me, but it's very convenient.
This defense attorney, Bill Wendt, he tried his best. I mean, he's saying there's nothing tying him. The letter was tested. There's nothing to show that he was connected to it at any point. He's also talking about the embezzling that happened, and he's trying to say that, well, George did it for his family. Don't believe that he was doing it because he loved material things. He's actually doing this to give his family a wonderful home, which, wow, they're trying to build his character up before the jury after the prosecution is tearing it down. It's a very difficult job. So again, this letter that Lisa wrote that the prosecution maintains is maybe 6 months old. The defense is saying it's 2 to 3 years old. The judge had to make a call on it. And the judge said, you know, this is hearsay, but it's also relevant to the case. So, of course, it stays in. Justin, there's nothing more crucial to the prosecution's case than this note, right?
Well, if you're found guilty and the defense is going to appeal your case, then absolutely they're going to put all the weight on this note. But I think that there's a lot of other evidence here. There's a lot of other things that point to guilt besides the letter. But in a court of law, yeah, this letter was the pivotal piece of evidence for the state.
Well, I say it's the crucial piece because it's one thing to say we have all this circumstantial evidence that suggests that George was behind the murder. But this letter from his own wife to him, it's basically saying he has anger issues, that she can't live like that anymore. And this letter was found in his stuff. It was found in his things. He kept the letter. This is something that we'll get into later, but the defense will later try to use that to their advantage. So the jury spent about 9 hours deliberating. February 11th, 1996, George was convicted of capital murder and received life in prison without any possibility of parole. And that's because the jury said no to the death penalty.
Which I think is appropriate based on all the facts and evidence included in this case. So I think it's just, but you know the defense is going to appeal and they're absolutely going to look at this letter as hearsay and should have not been deemed admissible for the trial.
The defense definitely tries to bring up many points, 12 points of error. But the court, after reviewing them, only considered two. And so this is the quote. This court only looks to whether there is sufficient evidence from which reasonable jurors could have found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And of course, this inadmissible hearsay letter, as they knew it, was definitely being reviewed. Before we go on, Justin, we should talk about this. When you have something that's inadmissible hearsay, talking about a crucial piece of evidence that might be withheld from a courtroom, what are they trying to do with that? Are they trying to make the case harder on the prosecution?
It's not that they're trying to make the prosecution's job more difficult. They're just trying to defend their client. They don't want any prejudicial evidence that is not based on facts, not based on anything relevant. And they see this letter as being very prejudicial, and when it was written, cannot be verified. So they don't want it going in.
This goes beyond what a defense might want. This is part of the justice system's attempt to be fair to defendants, because it's difficult enough. If you have a charge against you of murder, you're already working from the ground up. You're at a disadvantage from the start. We've talked about this many times. It doesn't matter that you're innocent till proven guilty. Many times it feels like you're guilty until proven innocent. To me, this is just protection for people. In other words, let's put the bulk of the responsibility on the prosecution to get this right. They'll have to work for it. Prejudicial evidence like this can make their job so much easier because they can point to it and say, you don't see Lisa up here on the stand. Lisa Revell was murdered, but we do have something she wrote to her husband, and we'll read that to you in court today. When they do that, they're basically bringing in a person who's been murdered and allowing them to speak. But you're not really getting their words. You're getting a note that they wrote months or years ago. And so they can manipulate this to their own end. And that's where the court, I think, has a duty to look out for defendants, even if we believe them to be guilty. There has to be some protections. Otherwise, prosecutions would have a much easier time.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with the sentiment there. I agree with we need to do everything in our power to defend the accused. It's just interesting to me that in so many other cases, stuff like this is absolutely admissible, not even challenged. It just seems to be rubber stamped in. So I was surprised that this letter became such a point of contention.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
If you showed me 20 other cases where similar pieces of evidence were admitted and were used to get a conviction of a defendant, then I would still argue that this one case, they got it right. They needed to do this because the playing field has to be equal. And this would make it very unequal, I would argue. And that's what happened. We saw that George Revell was convicted. He was given a life sentence. So when the court is reviewing this, they're seeing what we saw, which was this is a very prejudicial letter. And you can argue that it's relevant, but you're not arguing from a factual standpoint. I mean, you're saying this is what she was thinking and that she continued to feel that same way up until her murder. But there isn't evidence of that. In fact, some might argue, let's just say it was 6 to 8 months old. We'll go with the prosecution's timeline. Then why hadn't she left him? Why hadn't she even asked for a divorce or anything? They were still together. So maybe George's story of, well, we patched things up, and this is something else he said, we patched things up and I kept that letter as a reminder of how bad things can get and not to let it get that way again. But we just don't know what Lisa was thinking or feeling around the time of her murder.
The defense appeals on a bunch of other points about the case. One of them was the judge should have recused himself because obviously George was the mayor of the town and had dealings with the judicial system. But at no point during the first trial did the defense call for the judge to recuse himself. So as we say, was that strategy? Was that just something missed? I don't know if you can retroactively go back and say the judge should have recused themselves unless you have absolute proof that there was a conflict of interest.
So George Revelle got a retrial. November 1997, the Missouri Court of Appeals vacated his conviction. They said that note was inadmissible hearsay, just as the defense was asking for them to say, and so it should never have been included as evidence in his trial. The retrial happened in December of 1998, and this time we have different attorneys, Justin.
The prosecutor is nicknamed Dr. Death, if that's not foreboding enough.
Apparently, he was very aggressive in getting death sentences. And the attorney now representing George was named Sean Askenozy, who I, from my understanding, is a very respected defense attorney and cares very much about defendants' rights. So they get this jury for this retrial from Henry County, Missouri, which is about 110 miles away from Ozark. And the defense this time is much more well-equipped to defend their client. One, because they don't have this letter hanging over them in the court, but also because they start to go over the evidence a little harder. They say that the sheriff's department really didn't investigate this letter other than they drained the pond and found the gun. They wanted them to look into it further. They wanted them to track down the people in the letter. This was the letter that had been sent to the sheriff's department claiming that George Revelle was innocent.
Yeah, but his half-brother died prior. So that was sort of a dead lead, a dead end. There was no lead there. So,
well, what about the other two men named in the letter? The sheriff's department didn't really look into this. They didn't try to find out who he was connected with, if he had made calls to anyone around the time. They just said, well, we don't believe it, essentially.
I mean, being that Ronnie Kistler, his half-brother, died before the murder, I don't know how much the police officers could have investigated that. I know that there were two intruders, but did they have any leads for those two people, being that the brother, the half-brother, was dead?
Like I said, they could have looked up phone records. They could have done something. And all that the defense attorney is saying is, if you're going to dismiss evidence without looking into it, then why should we take you seriously? There was just no attempt. I think all they did was they attempted to find fingerprints or DNA on the letter to see if it would tie to George. There's something else that's kind of interesting. I don't know what you make of it, but Lisa's autopsy, there were photos taken during that, and two of the photos were missing. And of course, it said that two of the lead investigators may have taken the photos, so they weren't available anymore. So the defense kind of makes a big deal out of this because, well, this is missing evidence.
And again, there's never a case that's perfect. And whether there are missing autopsy photos proves somebody is guilty or innocent, I don't know. But it does show that there is missing evidence and there's something wrong with the case.
Well, Askenozy, the defense attorney, was able to figure out why these photos may have been misplaced. And that's because in one of them, one of these detectives had placed his hand over Lisa's chest. And it was said that the same detective had made crude comments because he had never seen an autopsy of a woman with breast implants. So where, you know, in the first trial, George's character was under fire. Well, in this retrial, the defense attorney is going after investigators now and saying, these are the people leading the investigation, and this is what's coming out of their mouths.
That's what sucks, is I think George appears very suspicious. I think that there's a lot of evidence against him. But during the investigation, if you pull pranks like that, it disrupts all your credibility in the face of a jury.
It was known that investigators spent about 1,000 hours in the Revelle home looking for any kind of evidence. They never found the murder weapon there. So, of course, the defense attorney is saying, they had that much time in the home and never found the gun. How was he able to hide the gun there and then move it to the pond later? How did he trick the detectives?
The detectives had tunnel vision and were looking at George, but then the detectives are also incompetent and unable to find the murder weapon in a home that the defense is saying wasn't there in the first place.
Also, the defense brings in an alarm expert named Jeffrey D. Zwirn, who recreates the Revell home alarm system so that he can show how an intruder or intruders could break in easily. And that's because the alarm system wasn't properly programmed or installed. He described it as untrustworthy. So a lot of time is spent on this. And really what he's doing, as what you know should be obvious, is they're saying, you know, that alarm system that the security systems or the security company said was showing that no one entered the home. Well, they don't know what they're talking about. We have an expert in the courtroom who is spending quite a lot of time showing how this is not a trustworthy alarm system. So don't believe any of that. They're breaking this case down, and the prosecution is having a hard time on this retrial.
Yeah. And when you do look at each of the pieces, they're all extremely suspicious. They're all very convenient. But in a court of law, it's hard to prove any single point here because the murder weapon wasn't found at the home. Did the security system work properly? Just because you don't see footprints leading away from the house, does that mean nobody ran away from the house? No, it doesn't. So I think common sense shows that George probably did this, but beyond a reasonable doubt, that's what you have to prove in a court of law. And how does this second trial go, Aaron?
Well, one of the things that I read was that because this security expert was so good with his testimony and was showing how this alarm system was untrustworthy, that the state didn't even bring on an expert to counter him. It's almost like they said, yeah, they beat us there. The jury decided on December 13th, 1998, that George should be acquitted. And that's something I think a lot of people have a hard time with, just because there are so many circumstantial pieces in this case that say George must have done it. But, you know, this is why we have a trial, is you have these experts going after each other, trying to prove their cases. And it just so happened that, well, Askinosie did one hell of a job proving that George wasn't guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the jury had to do what was right and acquit him. And as far as this life insurance policy, in an interesting move, his children received the $1 million. I say it's interesting because George was the only recipient, but the children got the money. George received more good news because on December 17th of the same year, he was released from his federal embezzlement sentence.
I'm torn on it because this is how our system should function. This is reasonable doubt. But I'm looking at all the evidence here and I'm just thinking to myself, there is the evidence pointing to his half-brother hiring people to do a home invasion and extort money from George and his wife. There's less evidence of that than George planning the murder of his wife. But just because you have more checkboxes in one than another doesn't get to that threshold of beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think that George probably planned this and did this, but I can't really fault the court systems here.
The checkboxes, at least for me, are usually, what do I think? But of course, there is that threshold when it comes to an actual conviction. And I think in this case, Askinosie says it best when he said that if George wants to thank someone for his freedom, he should be thanking Jeffrey Zwirn, because that's where he really feels this case was won. Once they got Lisa's letter out of the way, then it was all on the security system. How did these men enter the home? If we believe the security system worked properly, then that shows, and you're the one who brought this up when we talked about it, that there were no intruders, because when he fired the gun, that set the alarm off. But if you can't trust the alarm system, if it's garbage, and it may very well have been, then that doesn't matter anymore. You can't use the security system to show anything. But we've covered cases like this before, Justin, where we think one way on who's actually guilty, but we also respect how the court acted, because it needs to be fair. People have rights. We spent so much time talking about the importance, the relevance, or possible hearsay of Lisa's note to her husband, George. And this is the note. To George from Lisa. Maybe this is the only form you will read, like an office memo. I can't seem to tell you anything without feeling your anger, so I'll try to write down my feelings. I am very scared about our marriage and our family. I can't continue living this way. I'm afraid of you, afraid of your anger and your silence. I find myself telling the kids not to bother you. I find myself tiptoeing around the house, and I won't do it anymore. Life's too short for this garbage. If you can't talk to me, then find someone you can talk to. Your indecision about your job, our home, everything right now has nothing to do with me. Find out why you're stalling. I don't want a big new home or a Mercedes or a Highland membership. I only want someone who loves me and accepts me as I am. I need someone who cares what I think and wants me to be a part of his life. What do you want? I've often thought that it would be easier if you were having an affair. At least that would be something tangible I could deal with, but I don't know how to deal with this. I've tried to give time, but nothing happens, and you don't seem to want it to change. You probably don't even believe anything is wrong. Just to live in a house together isn't enough. I try to find out about your work, but you cannot reply. When did you ever ask me about summer school classes? I want to be a part of your life, and maybe you don't care about mine, but at least be honest enough to tell me. I'm hurt and alone, and the kids feel it too. I see Stan shutting down his feelings too, and it makes me sad. Candace is just plain angry, and I know she can feel my pain and your anger. I will always love you, but I won't live with you like this. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.